Good morning. So with series in Ruth, after spending some time the early part of this year looking at the story of Peter, and then from Peter, we piggybacked on our journey on a Sunday morning through Acts. Now for certainly the next four or five Sundays that I take, we will be looking at the book of Ruth. So before we start looking deeply into the book of Ruth, I thought it might be just helpful to understand exactly where the story is set and the context and time within which the story occurs. It's a map of the area which really covers a period of time after the reign of King David. But it's good for us to be able to understand where the nation sat, at least. Obviously, at the time of which we're talking about here, the Kingdom of Israel, the Kingdom of Judah is Israel, it's a united nation. But the Philistines were and are located to the left-hand side there, sitting along the coast. They were a thorn in the flesh of the children of Israel, on and off. We will see them, obviously, with David, with the story of David and Goliath. We will see numerous occurrences of battles between them and David and his troops. But also, if you then go back to Samson and the story of Samson, there will be the story there. And also, if you look at Eli and the story of Eli and Eli's sons, again, you'll come face to face with the Philistines there. Down to the south of the Kingdom of Judah, you see the Kingdom of Edom. But the area that we're particularly looking at, very briefly, is the Kingdom of Moab, which is across the Dead Sea. To be able to get to there, they would have crossed over the Jordan, probably somewhere near Jericho, up to the north of the Dead Sea there, and then gone into the Kingdom of Moab. Bethlehem itself is located, if you look on the map, you will see Jerusalem, and you'll see the J of Jerusalem. Bethlehem is really located probably at the bottom of that journey. So it's quite close to Jerusalem. The journey that they would have undertaken would be a journey of around about 55 miles, where they would have gone around the top and then into the Kingdom of Moab. So they've gone out of the Israelite territory, the Promised Land, and gone into a land which at different times would have been an enemy to the children of Israel. It would appear at this moment in time there was a degree of understanding and maybe peace between the nations as the famine hits and bites into Israel. There isn't a famine in the Kingdom of Moab. Here you can see the modern map of the area. Moab itself is located in today's country called Jordan. That's where the red pin is. Israel, obviously, is to the left, and Bethlehem is marked with the blue pin. Jordan's a beautiful country, and it's sandwiched in a really interesting geography, with Syria to the north, Iraq to the right, to the east, and then to the southeast and south, you will find Saudi Arabia. And then across on the left-hand side, i.e. to the west, you will see Israel. And at the bottom there, you will see Egypt as well. So that's the area where we're talking about here. And if we zoom in onto the map, you will see that the journey which they would have taken, which would have taken us from the blue pin right the way across the Jordan through to the Moabite area. If we look at the satellite image there, you can see that the Dead Sea itself, it is low-lying, and it sits effectively below sea level. And you can see the embankment as it rises up to the plains above. And if we zoom in onto the plains of what is today Jordan, but in those days would have been Moab, you can see that it is a cultivated and a fertile area even today. So as far as geography and where it was set,
we've now got a good idea where they've travelled and the journey that they would have taken to get there. But when is this set in history, and how does it fit into the biblical narrative? And clearly anybody that understands their Bibles will appreciate that the story of Ruth will occur at some point during the book of Judges. Exactly where, if you look at the various different books and different history books and the biblical books, they're a little bit divided as to exactly what timeline occurred. But there are a number of clues within the book of Ruth which can help us locate history when this story took place. So for a few days this week anyway, I was delving into a number of different books to try and get an understanding of exactly when this story occurred. A really good source for any biblical scholar is Usher's work, which was written in the 17th century by Bishop James Usher, which was, he created a book called The Annals of the History of the World, which effectively looked at the Bible story right the way through from the Old Testament right the way through to the New Testament, and overlaid that with the history of the known world. So looking at the Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians, and looking how the Bible story sits on top of all of that and pulls it all together. It's a fantastic source of data and really helps any biblical scholar understand when various events took place and how everything pulls together. So I used Usher as my basis for trying to locate where Ruth was. Now, one thing that we must understand is that Jewish history and the history of the children of Israel effectively is based upon cycles of 49 years. And that goes back to when the children of Israel was established and when Moses goes up to Mount Sinai, he's given a number of instructions from God, not just the Ten Commandments, but a number of other instructions about the different laws and different rules, but also about the celebrations and festivals and how that they should behave. There was the year of the Sabbath, so every 7 years was set aside. And then the year of Jubilee, or the year of freedom, was the 49th, or the 50th year, so it was the 49th year in the cycle. So it was seven sevens. At that point, debts were forgiven, slaves were released and became free, etc. So the history of the children of Israel is then built on jubilees. And you can see from here that peace descends upon the land of Canaan in around about 1445 BC. And then the first jubilee then occurs in 1363, and as you see the dates are going backwards and backwards, because obviously we get closer to Jesus' birth, we're moving through that timeline where the number gets smaller and smaller as you get close to the birth of Christ. So you've got the first jubilee and the second jubilee, and so we move on. And then I've marked out a number of key events. I'm not going to explain what these key events are at this moment in time, but I'm just putting them there onto your radar. So the area that we're going to look at this morning really moves from around about 1250 BC right the way down to about 1050. So the 200-year period that we're going to look at. So the first thing then is to be able to put the judges into the right timeline. So we will do that now. And as I say, we're going to begin to look at that 1250 through to around about 1050. So the story of Gideon that you will remember from your Sunday school days, and we've preached on it a number of times throughout the years at Friends as well, the story of Gideon and the 300, well, that occurs at 1245. And Gideon himself dies in 1236. And he is then replaced
by Tola, who becomes a judge, and then Jair follows that, and so on, right the way down to Eli in 1157. And Eli judges, but is also the chief priest, and he is the chief priest until 1117, when he dies, and we'll have a look at that a little bit closer. And then that's where Samuel then takes over in 1117, and he dies somewhere around about 1060. The next series of events then to look at is really how some other events come on. Samson, who is a judge, judges during the same time that Eli judges, and he dies in 1117. Now, if you remember the story of Samuel, if you look in Samuel 1 Samuel 1, you will see that Samuel's mother, Hannah, is without child. And so she prays, and Eli overhears that prayer. And Hannah commits that if she is granted a child, that child will be given over to the Lord. And it is because of seeing that promise through that Samuel then effectively takes an apprenticeship, if you like, and is then tutored and looked after by Eli from that point forward. So he is the natural successor to Eli, and he is God's chosen and given messenger or prophet. And at the same time, you've got Samson, as I say, who judged over, although erratically, I would say, judged over the children of Israel. And he dies in exactly the same year that Eli dies. I wonder if you can imagine the trauma that was going through the children of Israel. Eli, if you recall, dies after hearing news that his two sons had taken the Ark of the Covenant into war against the Philistines, that they are killed, that the Ark of the Covenant is then captured, and Eli, in his shock and grief, falls over and breaks his neck and dies. And in that same year also, Samson, who had lived another great life, had succumbed to Delilah, had had his eyes plucked out, and is now bound and weakened, and is taken almost like a circus act to be ridiculed and laughed at a party of Philistines. And he asks and pleads with the Lord for one final time for the Lord's strength to descend upon him, and the Lord is gracious and allows him to do so. And Samson pushes out the columns, and that building collapses, killing many, many Philistines. So that trauma happens all in the same year. Saul, who becomes the first king of Israel, was born in 1125. So he was a young boy, he was 8 years old at the time of Samson and Eli's death. I wonder what impact that had upon that young man. Saul becomes king in 1095 when the children of Israel effectively turn their back yet again upon God and God's chosen route and decide that they want a king like all the other nations around them. They no longer wanted to be judged and to be looked after by chief priests and by the judges, but now want their own figurehead king. And so they choose Saul. And Saul dies in 1055. David is anointed by Samuel in around about 1063. So about 8 years before Saul is killed. And a large portion of Samuel is dealt with the conflict and the ongoing battle and jealousy that is established in Saul's heart against David, to the point of where Saul is killed and David eventually takes over and becomes God's chosen king of Israel and Israel's second king. So how does this help us understand how this fits into the biblical narrative, and how do we manage to position Ruth into the story? Well, we know that King David is effectively the great-grandson of Ruth. You can see from chapter 4 in Ruth, and also from the first book of Matthew, you can see the genealogy running down right the way through, certainly Matthew, right the way through down from Ruth, right the way through till to Jesus. And in the back end of Ruth, you can see from Ruth, from Obed to Jesse to David. So you can see the line and lineage of David. We know from Samuel that Jesse was an old man when David is born. We know that he had 7 other sons, and that David was the youngest. We also know that Obed was born shortly after the marriage and union of Ruth and Boaz. It's a bit of a plot or spoiler alert for maybe about 3 or 4 series later. But as we know, Ruth and Boaz do effectively become the great-great-grandparents of King David. And also, if you go down through the line and lineage, you end up right the way through to Jesus as well. So, positioning that, we can also look at part of the story that we hear in Judges, where it talks about an 18-year oppression that the children of Israel went through as they turned their back upon God yet again, in the many, many cycles that appear on and off throughout Judges. That oppression finishes in 1188. You can imagine that the land there has been oppressed, and that famine has come because of continual raiding from the Philistines and other nations coming into taking the crops, as they had done time and time again, which then brings a famine on the land. And it is a fair estimate to say that this oppression would have been the one which drove a number of the Israelites to leave Israel, to go to areas where there was plenty, of which in the story of Ruth, that was Moab. So the book of Ruth, if you look at the length and time, Jesse was probably born in between 1150 and 1160 BC, and that Obed would have given birth to Jesse around about that time. So you've got a gap there which takes us from King David's birth, which we do know took place in 1085, and we can then go back to being Obed was born in around about 1189, about a year after the oppression, to 1190, the year after. So within that 2-year period is where Obed is born, and the book of Ruth effectively comes to its end. So the book of Ruth then, you can see, was fit very nicely into the biblical narrative, which deals and comes in Jair's reign as judge, and that is the contextual area as to where Ruth fits within the Bible story. So we're going to sing one more hymn before we then look at our first passage that we want to look at in Ruth chapter 1.
But this morning I want to look at Ruth, and particularly looking at that passage which we find in Ruth chapter 1 and verse 16. Sorry, I'm not trying to be anonymous. Struggling with kicking the right button. Ruth chapter 1 and particularly verse 16. I mean, there are so many different passages that we could have looked at. We could have looked at the section there where Naomi says, "No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you because the Lord's hand has turned against me." And we could have preached the sermon, and we could have looked at whether or not the Lord's hand is against us at this time. the message that we've got this morning is more of one of change, opportunity, new life, a rejection of the past and a moving forward with God and seeing what God wants and focusing our attention solely and 100% upon God and God only. In verse 17, actually I'll read verse 16 and 17 and 18, but Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be ever so severely, that even death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. Now, this is a rejection of, it's a number of different things, but the first one I want to look at is a rejection of her past. Verse 13, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people. Your God, my God." It is a putting aside of everything that has made Ruth, Ruth, up until this point. And now it is about focusing upon what it is that she has encountered and to be able to see that the past has gone and the future stands before her. A new nation, a new place to dwell, a new people to call her own. But the one that really stands out is not the people, it's not the place, it's not where they are, but your God will be my God. That is the deciding factor. That is the most important thing that occurs in this verse. The thing that is lost in the NIV is in verse 17. "Where you die, I will die, and there I'll be buried. May the Lord deal with me." The Lord there, that is the name Yahweh that is being used by Ruth. It's God's holy name. She knows who it is that she is focusing her attention and love upon. So she is rejecting her gods that she had had before, the Moabite gods, and she has adopted not just the people, the children of Israel, but she is adopting and taking on God. In 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 16, it reads, "So from now on, we regard no one from a worldly point of view. Though we were once regarded Christ in this way, we no longer do. Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, the new creation has come and the old has gone. The new is here." You see, when you reject your past, you need to leave it in the past. When we reject our old ways, we need to leave our old ways where they were and embrace Christ in his way and move forward with him. Do you ever repeat sins that you have dealt with or have been dealt with in the past? Are there sins that reoccur? Are there memories that take you back to a time before Christ dealt with you? Then remove them. Put them to one side. Reject the past and focus upon Jesus. Focus upon what he is doing in your life and move forward. There is an adoption of the future. So my second point, the first was rejection of the past. My second point then is an adoption of the future. She is going to go where Naomi goes. She's going to stay where Naomi stays. She is going to take the people, the children of Israel, as her people. She's going to take her God as it is her God as her own God. So Naomi's God as her God, the children of Israel's God. Yahweh is now the Lord in her life. She is looking forward to the future. Ephesians 4 and verse 22 to 24 reads, "You were taught with regard to your former way of life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds and to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. There is an absolute desire for change, and there is a freeness that comes, a liberty that is ours if we adopt that new future. That we don't hanker back to the past, that we don't dwell there, that we don't look at it either with the eyes of guilt or eyes of longing, but we're to adopt the new future, put off our old self, clothe ourselves with Christ's righteousness, and move forward with him. See, Ruth is binding herself. So my third point is binds the commitment. She is binding herself. Where you die, I will die. There I will be buried. May the Lord, and this is it, this is where she's binding herself. She is using the name Yahweh. May Yahweh deal with me, be ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. We used to have a text that used to sit behind the main screen, and a number of you will remember it. And it read, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whosoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him." He binds his commitment by dying on the cross so that we can be free. Ruth is calling upon the name of the Lord and binding herself to her promise, to her commitment, that she will have and adopt this God as her God. She will take God as her own. She will be there for Naomi until the day that they die, and then may that not even separate them at that point. And so we have been bound to Christ. We have been bound to God by Jesus' death, because he has paid the price so that we can be new people. We can be changed and transformed because Christ bound himself and bound us through his death and through his glorious resurrection. I do like that last the last verse 18. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So my final point this morning is acceptance. Naomi accepted that Ruth was determined. She had heard her reasoning and she accepted that reasoning. How could she argue with the reasoning, the logic? How could she argue with somebody who had rejected her false gods and had now taken the true God to be her God? How could she send her back? How could she send her away from God's presence and send her back to her mother? She couldn't. In a way, this reminds me of a situation which we had, Ellie will crown me now, and we had with Ellie a few years ago. It was that dreaded time when you had to choose which school your children were going to go to. And like a good parent, I believe we are a reasonably good parent, we did our research and we looked at the various schools that were around for Elle's to go to. We did the trips, we did the tours, we spoke to people, and we knew the direction that Ellie should go. And so we sat down with Ellie and we went through the process with her, and lo and behold, she chooses the exact opposite school to the one that we had chosen. Now, there's one of two things as a parent you can do here. Either you can be the parent that says, "No, we know what's best, and you're going to have to do what we say." Or you sit down a bit like Naomi does here and says, "Okay, well, tell me why. Tell me why it is that you want to go this way." And so Ellie And I remember it now, sat down where I'm sitting here now, and we sat down and we talked it through, and she reasoned it through, and she explained why she wanted to go. And her reasoning was right and was sound. And we sat here and we pushed the button on the computer that sits in front of me now, and that was the school that she chose. And so it is with Naomi here, that she is listening. She knew what was best. I mean, there was no way that Naomi was going to have another son. And even if she did, as you rightly said, would Ruth really wait until that young baby had turned to a young child, who had turned to a young adult, and then became a suitable replacement? What lay in front of Ruth and Naomi? What happiness could there possibly be? What future was there? But when Ruth explains what it is that she set her heart upon, the impact that God and Naomi's faith had clearly had upon her life, and that she had seen it wasn't just a whim, it wasn't just a desire, but there was something fundamentally far more important. That Ruth had come face to face with the true and living God, and that she wanted that future. And her way of expressing that love, which she had seen from Naomi, but more importantly from God, was now to show that love back to Naomi and to see her commitment through to her dying day. Romans 5, verse 17 reads, "For if by the trespass of one man death reigned through that one man, how much more will those who receive God's abundant provision of grace and of the gift of righteousness reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ?" Consequently, just as one trespass resulted in condemnation for all people, so also one righteous act resulted in justification and life for all people. What amazing words. For the trespass of Adam, the human race is condemned. Sin has come into creation, and creation is on destiny to conflict with God and ultimately lead him to our ruin. But God has a glorious plan. He has a plan that is seen in the Old Testament, where he chooses the children of Israel and he chooses the patriarchs, and he sets his heart upon that nation, a nation that will be his nation and that will be his people that will love him. They won't be perfect. They most definitely weren't. I mean, look at Samson. We alluded to Samson earlier. In many, many regards, he's not a good man. Look at David, mighty David. The David who conspired in the death of someone who he slept with out of wedlock and was now destined to have a child through. This is not a good man. But he is a good man because he has his heart is for God. We are not perfect people, but we are accepted. We are forgiven by Jesus Christ because of the price that he paid, so that we can one day stand in front of Almighty God as Jesus' bride. This is a wonderful book. I love the book of Ruth. It's a beautiful book. It is a love story, but it is so, so, so much more. That's all I wanted to cover with this morning. So we were looking at the rejection of the past. We were looking at the adoption of the new future. We were looking to the bound and the bound commitment of Jesus Christ and the root there. And we look at that glorious acceptance and that wonderful acceptance that each one of us has. I wonder if we can sing our final hymn together, and that is "Before the Throne of God Above."